I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Austin and Jim. It seems like it'd be a good idea to talk a little bit about herding cats. And what I mean by that is the Pan-Arab Coalition and the coalition that is going up against ISIS. Austin, you wrote a column about this recently. Could you talk a little bit about that and maybe give us some background on it?
You mean the column about prospects for a Pan-Arab army? That one last month? Yeah, by the way, Dan, I ended up on CCTV, the Chinese CCTV America, the Chinese English language American netcast, but they also do some things, I understand, broadcast as well, discussing this particular column and the subject. Look, it is difficult to get the Arabs to agree on anything, even though you can find at least areas of rhetorical agreement. And I'll call that rhetorical agreement, whether you all have the same words. But turning that into diplomatic agreement, where they have a common, combined, and applied diplomatic policy or diplomatic program is very difficult and rare, and even more rare is actual on-the-ground, sustained on-the-ground cooperation. Now, you can point to coordinated attacks on Israel of sorts. The 73 war is an example, which the Jordanians stayed out of. The 67 war was sort of coordinated. The Jordanians were in that one, as well as the Egyptians and Syrians. So there are those instances. But the discussion now is how to go about defending Saudi Arabia, Persian Gulf Arab states, with several uncomfortable realities and some very uncomfortable indications. The uncomfortable realities is the Islamic State, the Iranian nuclear quest, Iranian muscle flexing in the Persian Gulf, the uncomfortable implications, U.S. withdrawal, lack of U.S. Reliability. And that can work in several ways, because for years the United States has also been encouraging regional allies and regional actors to assume a greater burden for their own defense. So there's a little tension with that, but nevertheless, the superpower can provide super diplomatic and military power and exercise it convincingly when the, as you said, herding cats, when the herd of cats is not so convincing. In fact, as from the Iranian perspective, Arabs acting together, well, we'll just pick them apart piece by piece, either by threatening individually, corrupting individually, attacking individually, or the type piecemeal defeat in detail, it would be the Iranian strategy there. Nevertheless, to get back to a Pan-Arab army, looking at something that could deal with the situation in Yemen with the Houthis, and also provide a bulwark, or at least an initial bulwark, against the Iranians. And the Saudis have been promoting this. You can find roots of it, Dan. It's not something that just sprang up this year. I found it an article that discussed some defense military training exchanges that the Egyptians had conducted with the Arabian Peninsula countries, all but said Saudi Arabia, at least some what I would guess would be planning contacts, in November of 2014. And it alluded to earlier contacts in 2013. Now, the Egyptians and the Saudis have cooperated over the years. The Saudis provide the Egyptians with financial support, and Egypt is in terms of population. It's the largest Arab country. The Egyptians participated in Desert Storm. So did the Syrians. But the Saudis have the economic wherewithal. The Egyptians have the military wherewithal. So there's the beginning of a pan-Arab army that's really Saudi money and Egyptian military. The other component that of this thinking about the initial ground forces, initial pan-Arab army, are the Jordanians. So the Jordanians have a good, well-trained army. The UN loves to have Jordanians. They trace their roots to the Arab Legion, British trained. They have a competent little air force. They have a very good special forces capabilities. Plus, they also have close ties to the Israelis. I guess I'm working back a little bit there. The Israelis are well positioned to provide behind the scenes intelligence support and other deep support functions for such a primarily Arab ground force. Now, you work your way along the Persian Gulf littoral, Kuwaitis, Qataris, but when you hit the UAE, the Emiratis have a really good little air force, rates well in terms of pilot training. They have modern systems. They devoted a lot of money to improving their ground support systems. Jim's very aware of what they've done maintenance and sustainability-wise. And even though and the Iranian Air Force, like the Iranian Navy, is in miserable shape, the Saudi Air Force is not in bad shape either. But the Qataris should give the Iranians worry. There have been actually four or five articles that have touched on that over the last 6 months that I've noted. Would the Qataris cooperate with the Saudis and Egyptians? I think the answer is absolutely yes, especially when they feel that the Iranians have decided they are going to use go to war. That's right there on the Strait of Hormuz, so that internationalizes the war right there. But if there was a fight between the Iranians and this notional pan-Arab force, but there are components there, and despite the herding cats mentality, if you've got Saudi money and enough. There's enough fear that the Iranians are going to act. If you can get a substantial Egyptian ground force into the region, and they have the lift to at least get it across the Red Sea and the ability to move it, and they're only talking right now about a 40,000-man force. 40,000 troops. What would it constitute? Well, it looks to me like that's a couple of Egyptian divisions and other contingents. Would it be sufficient? I don't know. Depends on what the Iranians would put up. Where would it be positioned? I don't know. King Khalid Military City hosted a couple of Pakistani brigades for, I forget the number of years, but they were there. The Pakistanis are no longer providing the mercenaries for the Saudis, but the KKMC, as it was called in the late 80s and early 90s, the facilities are there, and there are some very good garrison facilities in Saudi Arabia, support facilities. So it's something that wouldn't be instantaneous. It begins with herding cats, but you might get, you might get something. I don't know where it did. You might get a few tigers out of it, Dan. It's not something that the Iranians should dismiss. Now, when I said I was on that Chinese television show, they had a spokesman from Tehran who has spent all of his time just typical Iranian attitude towards Arabs. Oh, they can't do this and they can't do that. And I finally said, well, the Iranians have lots of troubles themselves. They've got their capabilities are questionable. And for good reason. It's just the Arabs is more out in the open than the Iranians. He had no response to that. That happened to be the end of the program, so who knows what. But he, if he'd battled with me, he may have run the risk of ticking off the Ayatollahs who were his masters, so who knows. I'll turn this over to Jim. I think I've given an idea of what – if I miss something, Jim, on the military analysis, let me know.
Jim?
The most populous countries in Arabia have always been Yemen and Saudi Arabia. The big difference between the two is that Saudi Arabia has most of the world's oil, or the largest chunk of the world's oil any one country holds. And the Yemenis have very little oil and are not nearly as united as the Saudi Arabians are. That said, Austin made a good point about the smaller, Gulf countries, the Qatar, UAE, and what have you. Those countries, by and large, they have oil, but they are basically much better off because they have diversified their economies. In the UAE, it's something like the United Arab Emirates, something like 70% of their GDP is from non-oil sources. And they have done this on purpose. Partly it's because they just have a lot less oil, but partly because they've always been trading countries. Arabia itself was this collection of, oasis-based, agricultural communities and nomads. It was a godforsaken place. I mean, it's mostly one big desert with a few, green spots. And that was one of the problems with it never being united, because there wasn't a hell of a lot to unite. The Saudis came in there and they basically used religion to unite it, positioning themselves as the best guardians of the Muslim holy places at Mecca and Medina, which for centuries has brought in, many Muslims each year as pilgrims. And that was basically a major part of the local economy because of the money they spent. Militarily, the Arabs have never been they like to present themselves as mighty warriors, but that disappeared centuries ago. Basically, history and technology passed them by. The Golden Age was in the 7th century when Muhammad, began Islam, and they began conquering the neighboring countries, who were basically fortuitously for the Arabs, they were largely in a state of decline, both the Eastern, Empire, the remnants, the Greek remnant of the Roman Empire, the Iranian Empire. They were lucky. They were lucky and they were good. And so, but they established this reputation of military competence, which didn't last much longer than the few centuries after the initial conquest. And since then, they've basically not improved. Oil made it worse. And that's the big problem that the Arab leadership has. They're aware of this. They've been aware of it for several decades. Oil is a curse, especially for countries that are not developed. It's one thing for Britain or Norway, or United States for that matter, to discover lots of oil, which all three countries have done, because the economy does not become dominated by it. It simply becomes another natural resource, and the United States had plenty of them. The Norwegians also had a lot of fish, which literally was a major, natural resource they used wisely for centuries. The Arabs got all this oil, all this new technology all at once, and it basically made their military capabilities worse. Now, the Iranians, who had a lot of oil but also had a much larger population, there are more Iranians in Iran than there are Gulf Arabs altogether. And this is something the Arabs can count. They're aware of that. But they're also aware of the fact that, A, the Iranians are much less dependent upon oil. They basically have to work for a living, as the Iranians like to put it. And secondly, the Iranians have a military reputation going back thousands of years, which has not really gone into decline nearly as much as the Arabs did. I mean, the Iranians were caught short by the Europeans who basically started their Renaissance and then their Industrial Revolution. The Iranians got run over by that. But they were smart enough to start picking up on it. Now, they never got a chance to do anything about it. And there was a great deal of fear in the 1970s, until the revolution that overthrew the Shah, that the Shah was modernizing Iran, and people knowing the Iranians and their history and their reputation, there was a great deal of fear among the Gulf Arabs that the Iranians were going to reestablish their empire. And until the religious revolution fortuitously came along, followed by an 8-year war with Iraq, a ruinous war for both countries, the Arabs were justifiably, you know, fearful. Since then, the Iranians have been further hobbled by, you know, more and more sanctions because of their support for terrorism, Islamic terrorism, and basically the religious dictatorship that runs the country since the 1980s. It keeps talking about, you know, world conquest and all this crazy stuff, which has, again, made it difficult for the Iranians to do what they feel they could do. And a lot of people, historians especially, agree the Iranians, if they got rid of the religious dictatorship and basically just were allowed to be themselves, as they are when they immigrate to Europe or the United States, they're very successful. They're very successful. But this bothers the Arabs because they know in a fair fight, shall we say, the Iranians would win. And unless the Arabs have powerful friends, which is why they're so nice to us, even though a lot of them hate us because we're infidels, et cetera, et cetera. Without a strong, you know, a foreign ally, the Arabs are toast. Now, the current situation basically demonstrates all the problems the Arabs have. They're factional. Extremely fast. We've written about this extensively. They don't trust one another. They have certain cultural habits which are not conducive to efficient military organizations. Now, one thing about the ruling class in the Arab world since World War II, when the oil money started flowing in and becoming, you know, more and more abundant, they had basically educated several generations of, you know, technical people and leaders who are aware, became aware. They didn't believe all the old stories, which is basically all you had in Arabia in the 1940s and 50s and even into the 60s. The leaders understand. But a lot of the subjects do not. Or if they do, they're not willing to practice what they preach. For example, in most of those oil-rich Gulf countries, upwards of 90% of the businesses are run by foreigners who are brought in under contract. I'm talking about not just operating the businesses, building the structures, running oil fields and what have you. They say, hey, we can afford it. Let's buy people, so to speak. They call them slaves, you know, out of earshot, not to their faces. Well, not usually to their faces. But they feel, why should we work if we don't have to? Now, by the 1980s, the leadership realized that this was a bad situation to be in. They were especially chagrined at the poor performance of the Iraqi army against the Iranians, which wasn't a total surprise, but the Iraqis had bought all these new weapons, just like the Gulf Arabs had done. And they just barely hung on. I mean, it took tens of billions of dollars of gifts from the Arab countries, other Arab countries, buying all these weapons and then using chemical weapons, which both sides ended up using, you know, World War I type stuff plus nerve gas. And the best the Iraqis could do was a stalemate. And a lot of thoughtful Arabs said, oh my God, what if we had to fight the Iranians? What shape would we be in? So they've been scrambling. Now, the problem is, to this day, the Arabs can't put together, despite having access, you know, including Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and the other smaller Gulf states, they can muster a total of, leaving out Yemen, which was never part of the party for various reasons we won't go into, they can muster a total population, maybe 50 million people. But out of that 50 million people, you think, hey, they could get a couple hundred thousand. I mean, if it were a European country, they could raise a professional military of several hundred thousand, you know, capable troops. They can't do it. The problem is, if a lot of Arabs in these Gulf countries don't want to basically, you know, go into construction or pick up the garbage or anything like that, they sure as heck don't want to be competent soldiers. They tried hiring mercenaries, But this made the leadership very nervous. Another thing that made them nervous was there was a small percentage of the population that were attracted, you know, from for whatever reason, this exists in every culture, to, you know, the disciplined life of professional, you know, military, career. And this is where you got your special forces, you know, your SWAT teams and what have you. But this also made the leaders, rulers nervous, because they noticed that historically there were elite units, in Arab countries, and they were often the people who led coups, you know, to overthrow the rulers if, you know, the rulers basically offended the wrong people. So that made them nervous. And that counts for a lot more in Arab culture than it does in other cultures. So they basically, they couldn't hire mercenaries. They couldn't trust them. They were fearful of basically, you know, paying enormous sums of money to their own people to join the military and then trying to motivate them to actually do the training and what have you. And we had generations of American and European trainers who were hired to train them coming back and telling me and telling a lot of people in the Pentagon, says, you know, it just doesn't work. These guys, you know, it's like herding cats. You know, I mean, I don't want to. I don't have to. Screw you. You know, all right, I'll look good for the parade because the king's going to be there. But the other time, you know, just leave me alone. I'd rather smoke, you know, and basically relax. But hey, video games are great. That's training. So they realize that they haven't got an army. And that's one. And for an example, I mean, never mind. This is a lot of this sounds theoretical, but I give you a practical example. When starting in 91, you know, right after the horrors of the Gulf War between Iraq and Iran, we had the Americans, the first Arab coalition, as it were, but it was mostly, you know, NATO countries, coming in there, United States and Britain, to help liberate Kuwait from Iraqi occupation. Well, there was one incursion of Iraqis into Saudi Arabia. I forget the name of the place. But anyway, the king, the Saudis, even then and to this day, they have two armed forces. They have the regular armed forces, you know, Army, Air Force, you know, Navy and what have you. But then they have a second force, the National Guard, which is only recruited from tribes that are considered loyal to the House of Saud. I mean, this sounds very medieval, and it is, but for very practical medieval reasons. The king needs some insurance in case, for whatever reason, the army should become disloyal. And this is the National Guard. Now, these guys, some of them are full-time professionals, but most of them are basically loyal, and they consider themselves descendants of tribal warriors. Now, a lot of them are living in high-rises and basically, you know, living well and not doing a heck of a lot. But they have guns. They do some training and what have you. They have equipment as good as the army. And what did the Saudis send to throw the Iraqis out in 91 in this little desert skirmish on the border? The National Guard. Not the regular military, the National Guard. Now, fast forward to 2009. The situation in Yemen was heating up. And there was a border, you know, skirmish with the rebel Shia tribes who are now trying to basically conquer all of Yemen. So the Saudis sent the army in. And the army had a very hard time. They took heavy casualties. They eventually won, in quotation marks. Some Saudis say, well, you know, it was sort of a draw, you know. And in a way it was. The Shia tribesmen, who had a lot more experience fighting, did not advance far into Saudi Arabia because that's a howling desert. There's nothing to advance into. The oil is way on the other side of the country. So, you know, the short tribes basically wanted to make the point that you better not invade us or there'll be more of this, and they made their point. And that's one reason why the Saudis aren't mobilizing, you know, 50 or 60,000, well, they put 100,000 troops allegedly on the border. This is one reason why they haven't crossed the border. They sent their air force in, which is much better trained, and of course the enemy really can't shoot back, which is a big advantage. And they've been bombing the crap out of the Shia, but they haven't really stopped them cold, even with their air power. So the problem here is the only Arab country in this region that has a large army of fairly professional troops are the Egyptians. Now, as the Israelis will tell you, the Egyptians are not exactly stormtroopers. You know, they're not the best infantry in the world. But compared to the Arabs, they are, you know, much better. Because a lot of these Egyptian troops, that's their profession. There is not a lot of oil money. If you want a job, the military is hiring. We have standards. If you don't meet them, you're out. Now, the Egyptians have a problem in that they have an officer class, which is hired more for family reasons and loyalty than for military competence. And again, American and, you know, NATO foreign Western trainers, military trainers, usually veterans, who basically hire out to go over there and make a lot of money trying to train these guys. They'll point out that, yeah, this is a, it's a real problem. Now, part of their contract is not to talk to journalists. They'll talk to people like me, and they will talk to journalists, but not for attribution. Because otherwise, you know, they're blackballed and their company they work for is blackballed. So basically, they sign a do not fish, you know, clause in their contract. But it's an open secret. The Arabs know it. We know it. The Iranians know it. And of course, the Yemeni rebels, they know it. So the problem is the Arabs would like to have a large military force representative of their GDP and their relatively large population. You know, like I say, 50 million people they can draw from. But cultural factors, economic factors, actually they're meshed together. Too much oil money is a bad thing, especially if you're trying to put together a hotshot military. And that's the essence of their problem.
Hey, Dan, I'm going to have to cut out. Yep. Let me make a couple of quick comments. Jim got back to the crucial issue on this, is Egyptian participation, and a good summary of what the Egyptian army is like. Egypt and Jordan, remember, those are the two components or two countries I included in what I thought might be a workable cat herd and ultimately produce some tigers. They're both countries that where people have to work. As Jim points out, they don't have the affliction of too much oil. And the Jordanians also see themselves as having a fighting tradition and having kept it alive. So this could be done. It would take time. Again, how effective it would be, how long it would be able to put up a fight before the United States or Europeans intervened or the Japanese intervened. I toss them out because they have rely on Middle Eastern energy as well. Or the Chinese, who also rely on Middle Eastern energy, that may sound far-fetched. But it would also depend on how successful the Iranians were if we had faced a crisis like this. The components are there, and as Jim says, they're very intelligent people in the Arab world, have seen their weaknesses and are looking for ways to address them.
So, Jim, with the fight with ISIS, I mean, it sounds like one of the Western countries is going to have to step in and take a stronger leadership role there, and it doesn't look like right now that's going to be the U.S.
Well, the Saudis tried to get the Turks involved. Now, we've discussed the Turkish-Arab relationship before. Until, you know, about 100 years ago, when the Turkish Ottoman Empire was destroyed during World War I, the Turks had, for over five centuries, ruled the Arab world. This is something the Arabs still remember. You know, they talk about colonialism and foreign occupiers. We think they're talking about us, but culturally, emotionally, they're talking about the Turks. Even though the Turks were Muslims, the Turks were foreigners. They were not Arabs. They were not kind. Although the Turks like to think of themselves as cruel but fair. The Arabs respect Turkish military power. And in fact, it's one reason why the Erdogan, you know, the Islamic, so to speak, moderately Islamic Turkish government that's been running things for the last dozen or so years in Turkey, has been trying to make up, as it were, with the Arab world. They've had mixed success, but they've gotten far enough that recently the Saudis went to the Turks and said, look, you've got this mess right on your southern border in Syria. It's spread to Iraq, and it threatens to spread, you know, to the other Arab countries as well, ISIL, the Arab state, the Islamic state. And he says, why don't you just invade? Now, I wrote about this today in strategy page. The Turks basically made it very clear that, look, yes, and they do apparently have very frank discussions. Again, not for attribution because, again, Turkish military power in the Arab world is still a very touchy subject with most Arabs. The Turks said, look, and the Saudis respected the Turkish opinion. They said, look, this thing is going to go on for another couple of years before it burns itself out. And the Saudis said, well, all right, yeah, but what do we do in the meantime? He says, look, he says, we will go in when it basically collapses on itself. You know, there's factions fighting factions, fighting factions. You know, the mess just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. If you are threatened, we, and the Pakistanis have said, will intervene. We're not going to let a bunch of religious fanatics take over all that oil. The world needs that oil. The world economy needs that oil. The Turkish economy needs that oil. You know, we're going to look after our own interests, but it's not in our interest to go in now. Because if we go in now, we're going to be stuck in a quagmire for at least a year, and it's going to take us another 50 years to rebuild any rapport we have with the Arab people. But if we go in a 2 or 3 years when it becomes a total mess, we'll be hailed as saviors. It will help our situation and everybody's situation. We're sorry about the fact that we're going to have to let the whole thing, you know, basically melt down while we're all sitting here, but we can't justify it. Plus, it's not popular inside of Turkey. The Turks, when they got out, when they got kicked out, so to speak, of the Arab world, a lot of Turks were relieved. I mean, even then, even, you know, during the last days of the Ottoman Empire, there was a saying in the Turkish government, he says, do not involve yourselves with the affairs of the Arabs. Now, it was hard to avoid doing this, since they were running most of the Arab countries. But they had so many problems that they basically, a lot of Turks were relieved that, hey, we no longer have to basically partner with the damn Arabs. They can rule themselves. Let the victorious allies happen. They thought that was a great cosmic joke. You know, they lost the war, and the Europeans, or the French as they like to call them, they got all these Arab, you know, dependencies and colonies and provinces and what have you, and the Turks, you know, took great amusement in watching the Europeans have all the headaches that they used to have. Of course, then the Turks joined NATO. They said the Russians are still our enemy, but no, we're not doing anything with the Arabs. They're your problem now. So the Turks and the Pakistanis, they give the Gulf Arabs a ultimate insurance policy. In other words, if you're on death's doorstep, we will step in. But hey, if you're just feeling a lot of pain and discomfort, we can't do anything for you. We have our own problems. The Egyptians, for example, popular opinion in Egypt is very against going into, you know, Yemen or into the Arab world. Because, again, the Egyptians feel, in many respects, culturally superior to the Arab oil states, who are just a bunch of, you know, sand hillbillies. But they have the money and the Egyptians don't, so there's a certain, you know, relationship that's developed there. But they did in the 1960s go into Yemen in the midst of a civil war, and that worked out very badly for Egypt. They sort of won, but they lost a lot of people. They ended up using chemical weapons at one point. It's just an experience they don't want to repeat. They don't like the Islamic radicalism, and they're still having problems with that at home, and they'd rather keep the army there because they have Libya boiling over with Islamic radicals, and they still have some of their own that are causing problems. So they said, why should we send our security forces, you know, either into Libya or into Yemen when we need them at home? So there's no enthusiasm for sending troops. The West does not want to send any more troops into Arabia, shall we say, you know, Iraq or, you know, the Arab states, because we've done it recently, and it's a mess. It's what the Americans call a tar baby. You stick it and you can't get unstuck. So we'll help them. You know, we'll send advisors. Their air campaign, which is working fairly well over Iraq, Syria, and now in Yemen, has a lot of American support, you know, staff planning, technical advice, air-to-air refueling. We're supplying them with smart bombs, you know, technical assistance. But no, Arabs are going to fly those planes. They're going to choose the targets. They're going to take the heat for anything that goes wrong, not us. And the Arabs say, all right, we understand. You know, okay. So the Arabs can't get what they want in this case because of their own situation. And as many Arab rulers have been saying for, you know, decades now, we have to learn how to do all this stuff ourselves. And to many Arab leaders, this is basically a perfect situation for learning. In other words, we're going to make mistakes. Some of our soldiers are going to get hurt, get killed. We're going to take some bad heat in the media for like killing civilians or what have you. But that's the only way you learn how to do it, by experience. The Israelis are telling them the same thing. I mean, the Israelis are, that's one good thing coming out of all this. The Israeli relationship, which has basically existed for over two decades now, unofficially, very low key. You hear rumors about it occasionally, or even an occasional admission from some retired Israeli or Arab official. But now it's bubbling more to the surface. And the Israelis are telling them the same thing. He says, look, we've been intimate with Arab militaries, you know, so, and of course now the Americans and the British are too, recent experience. I says, we concur, and we live in the neighborhood, so we'd like nothing more than to have Arabs, competent enough to A, run their countries, and B, run their, provide their own military defense or internal security. But we're not going to send troops in. We have problems enough with the Palestinians. So there's where it sits. The Arabs are on their own. They have to do it themselves. And if they get themselves in a big trouble, things really start going south, then the Turks and the Pakistanis, and to a much lesser extent the West, will intervene to basically guarantee the oil supply. But the Arabs already understand, and they don't always like to admit it, that, in fact, that's one reason why America's been a friend, so to speak, of Saudi Arabia. One of the most intolerant, religiously and culturally countries in the world, since World War II, because the King Abdulaziz, the guy who founded Saudi Arabia in 1930s, who made those original deals, met with President Roosevelt, he said, we can trust these people because they don't want to steal our oil, they're willing to pay for it. And each generation of rulers since then has learned the same thing, that Grandpa, Aziz, was right, that the Americans will help us, but they have no interest in basically taking the oil. They can't say that for some of their neighbors, not just the Iranians, but they fear the Egyptians. A lot of Egyptians say, we could use that oil much more efficiently than those damn, Bedouins could. The Egyptians have never been able to act on it, but they talk about it, which makes the Saudis nervous. So they will basically do business with us, as it were, but they understand that we're not going to go in there and do their fighting for them. We'll save them. We'll be their last resort. And the Turks and the Pakistanis have basically said the same thing in the current situation. So the Arab leadership is basically doing, as the old American says, if all you have is lemons, make lemonade. They're making lemonade. They're telling their people, look, we're on our own. We've got to do the best we can. All we can expect from our bought and paid for allies, in other words, the Egyptians and the Pakistanis, who the Arabs have spent, given tens of billions to in charity and what have you. He says, you can only buy so much from these guys, and all they're willing to provide is the ultimate insurance policy. If things are truly desperate, then they'll step in. Until then, we have to learn how to do it. And that's probably a good thing. Not for the people involved, of course, because the death toll in Syria alone is likely to hit 300,000 by the end of the year. And Yemen is a real mess. But, what are you going to do? It's a messy part of the world, and they're finally learning to clean up after themselves.
Well, we'll leave it there and continue to watch things as we always do. Thanks, Jim.
Okay.
Bye.
Take care.